welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 3, The Outsiders from 1983. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And you know, Mike, before we introduce our guest, we gave Cage so much credit for going from 81 to modern day without skipping a year. Here, we already skipped 1982. He didn't do anything in 1982. I mean, at least, you know, that made it to screen.
Oh, well, I guess he took some time. I don't know. Needed to find some time. Even up until today, no one is quite the workhorse like Cage. So
the Mr. Cage.
Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, 8 movies in 2018 alone. So the man is a machine.
Well, to talk about The Outsiders today with us, we have the co-host of the Contenders podcast. She was on our Bosom Buddies Season 1 episode, if you listened to that last week, over on our other Tom podcast on Hanks for the Memories. We have Aislinn Addington. Hello, Aislinn.
Hello. How are you two this evening?
Very well. And how are you doing?
Fantastic.
Very good to hear. So you were saying before we started recording that Tom Cruise, you found a YouTube video where he is the 7 minutes of Tom Cruise in this movie, which I guess, for a movie kind of as short as this, isn't a terrible ratio, even though he's not really in the movie a whole ton.
Right. No, and I did watch, because then I was curious, like, okay, what does this look like? It is funny because he's in the background of a lot of scenes, so it wasn't a 1 7-minute performance, right? It was
right.
Probably 30 little clips, which was kind of unsettling to watch. But yeah, he's, I love a gang of misfits, and he's one of them. He's a misfit if I ever saw one.
It fits right in there.
It's funny because right off the bat, I noticed he had the most normal name out of all of them. You know,
I know. Like I was disappointed in that.
Yeah, there's like Soda Pop and, you know,
Tony Boy.
Yeah, and he's Steve Randall. It's like, yep. Okay. But it doesn't seem like 7 minutes, but you do spot him in the background a lot. So I like that.
Aislinn, you have a special honor here, just like you were last week on Hanks, episode 2. Once again, here on Cruise Club, episode 3, you are our first guest of this podcast.
Wow. That is an honor. I didn't do it on purpose, but I just happened to have some affection for this film.
Sure.
And story.
Well, we did it on purpose. We want to make sure that you were here with us very early. Bright
I'm
and
number
early.
One.
Set the pace. Question for you. We did not talk about this last week on Hanks because we had 19 episodes of Bosom Buddies to talk about. We had a lot to talk about.
I'm still tired.
Because there's not a ton. Me too. Because there's not a ton of Cruise in this movie, why don't you give us an overview? Do you have a favorite Tom Cruise movie? Do you remember the first one that you saw? Keeping in mind his movies, him as an actor, as an artist, what do you think of Mr. Tom Cruise?
So I like how you did that. So you're asking me to comment only on the acting so that you're not sued?
Well, yes, number one. But also number two, you know, for better or worse, we've talked about this in the podcast, and even on this one, that like Mike and I have somehow managed to basically separate the art from the artist. We sort of just look at the movies that they're in and, you know, the actors and the actresses that we cover, and then just sort of focus on that. So yes, and also to avoid lawsuits from a particular organization.
At the risk of starting a fight, you sort of seem to say that with pride that you separate the art from the artist, and I'm not sure. My first memory of Tom Cruise is being at our cabin on Flathead Lake with my mom, my uncle, and my grandmother. I don't know where Tobin and my dad were, but they were not there.
Your dad, Jeff Addington.
My dad, Jeff Addington, and I was tiny. One of my first memories ever. They wanted to go see this movie called Cocktail. There was a long discussion about who was going to have to stay home with me.
Oh.
And so I felt in the way. And then my mom had a brilliant idea. Well, I'll just bring a blanket and I'll throw it over her head.
Oh, no.
Which then I believe she said to the ticket taker, stereotypical ticket taker outside under the marquee, you know, because it was the 80s. And so, yeah, she walked in with a toddler and threw a blanket over my head when stuff got dirty.
So now, even blanket covered, you have seen more of Cocktail than I have, because I've never seen Cocktail.
Go.
There's a lot of the early Tom Cruise movies that I've never seen for one reason or another, just because I just didn't get to them. So, you know, even tiny little Aislinn, toddler Aislinn with a head covered in a blanket, has seen more Cocktail than I am. So do you have a favorite Tom Cruise movie, or does he?
I should be prepared for this. I think I have nostalgia for Top Gun.
Okay.
I have not watched it recently, so I can't tell you if or how it holds up, but I am just scrolling through here to see what popped.
I didn't need to hit you with such a heavy and hard-hitting question so early.
I would say A Few Good Men.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait
another
to
one
that.
I have not seen.
Really? Yeah, I'm an Aaron Sorkin enthusiast, and so yeah, I would say A Few Good Men.
Well, we will be getting to both of those sooner rather than later, Mike. I think in the next couple of months we will for sure be getting the Cocktail, and I think A Few Good Men's not too far behind.
1992.
So, yeah, so you know he's got a really big decade ahead of him, because this is the last time until Magnolia in 1999 that Tom Cruise is not the lead of a film.
Jeez.
So everything that we're doing from here on out for a long, long time, it's the Tom Cruise show. And I am very excited. As much as I enjoy Billy the Arsonist for 47 seconds, or I like Steve Randall here just gobbing down on a chocolate cake, which we will come back to in a big way, I want more. I just want more of him in these movies.
Well, so, you're going to get it, my friend.
Very, very, very excited.
Very
so now,
soon.
Mike, you were saying, you know, we started with Cage Club, and you said that this is like Rumblefish, because, again, you know, Uncle Francis got some of the similar actors. But, you know, who I was thinking of? This reminds me of Youngblood, because we got Rob Lowe, we got Patrick Swayze, we got a mid-80s, mostly male drama, ensemble drama. You know, this is, it's both similar and very different from movies that you and I have talked about already. Mm-hmm.
No, that's a good call. It's kind of like a blending of the two. I could see that, because it's like, it's the 50s, but it's from the 80s, so it has sort of that Youngblood's feel to it. Yeah, but I mean, I got heavy sort of, well, the whole greaser social sort of thing. I was thinking Jocks and Nerds, Hatfields and McCoys, and Montagues and Capulets. You know, it's a tale as old as time. Sort of the perspective is what sets this apart. Like, we're basically just with the greasers, and I thought that was kind of an interesting take on sort of a familiar setting, familiar plot of some type. But yeah, I mean, I'd only seen this movie once in its entirety, and this is kind of funny. I saw the second half first and the first half later. So, like, I came in halfway and watched the whole movie, and then I sat back down and watched it, like, from beginning to end. But I was just shocked again about how star-studded this thing is. You know, again, like Youngbloods. Like, that's a good connection again there, too. The ensemble here just blew my mind. I just kept forgetting. It's that guy. It's that guy. It's this person. It's that person. It was crazy.
Real quick, before we get too far from kind of how it's different than some of those other ones you mentioned, the other thing that I think is different, and one of the reasons that I wanted to be involved this evening, the source material is written by a woman and written by a teenage woman.
Well, I didn't know she was a teenager when she wrote it. That's awesome.
She was 15 when she started it.
Wow.
And then 18 when it was published. And, you know, the source material versus the film, I understand, is different. But also she was, you know, involved in the whole process. So that's the contender's reason that I'm here.
And that's also a little bit of Two Bits.
Oh, hey, shoot. Sorry. Just added a segment.
So I read this book in 7th grade English. And I probably saw the movie back then, too. The weirdest thing is, so part of the reason, I think we even might have talked about this either on the intro episode, the episode zero, Mike, or maybe in Taps or Endless Love. This was also covered by High School Slumber Party, by Brian Rodriguez of the High School Slumber Party podcast right here on the Cage Club Network. And he covered this about 6 months ago on his show. I totally forgot until I was about 10 minutes in the movie. I was like, oh, right, I watched this movie this summer. I had completely forgotten that I watched it when they covered it on their show, or when Brian covered it on his show. And I was like, why do I remember all of this so vividly? And I was like, oh, right, because I literally just saw it.
It's okay, because you've watched like 70 movies in December alone, so I forgive you.
I did, yes. I've seen hundreds of movies, not an exaggeration, since I watched this in July. It was actually 6 months ago yesterday, so almost exactly 6 months.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. You know, we were saying that, like, part of the reason we're doing Cruise Club, or not the reason we're doing Cruise Club, but like the reason that we had the idea to do this is because on that episode, Brian's guest mentioned this is like the last time that he's going to be a supporting actor. I was like, oh, because we were struggling through Charlize. We had sort of struggled through Keanu. Either they were not the lead or the lead in bad movies. I was like, wait a minute. We know that he's got a track record of good movies. If he's going to be the star basically from the jump, this is going to be a fun project to do. And so, once again, shout out to Brian and High School Slumber Party for kind of inspiring, in a way, this entire half of the Tom Tom project.
Yeah, and I'm just amazed about how much he's able to stand out amongst this crowd, too. You know, by not having a lot of screen time and not really doing all that much, he singles himself out, I feel. Like everybody, in a way, does, but
he has a presence, I notice him. For sure.
Yeah, totally.
Well, what I noticed, and this is maybe just because we're paying attention to him, but it also feels like, oh, wait, no, there's something going on here. It feels like when there's a bunch of them on screen, the camera follows him in a way that, like, it just sort of, for whatever reason, it hangs on him more than it does on, like, you know, Rob Lowe or Patrick Swayze or Matt Dillon or The Karate Kid or whatever. You know, it feels like that it's hovering
Macchio.
On him.
Poor Macchio. Jersey Strong.
It feels like they're lingering on him. Like, you know, at the end, there is that huge battle, the Greasers versus the Socs.
Yeah.
He's fighting a guy, and his fight's kind of unremarkable, and, like, he lands a punch, and he gets hit a couple times, and they cut away, then they cut back. Then all of a sudden, he's taking on two or three guys, and it's just, like, lingering on him. And then the Greasers win, or nobody wins, or whatever. He raises his arms into the sky in triumph. And the camera just sort of, like, stays on him for a while. And this is a movie that is filled with handsome dudes in the peak of their, you know, physical and sexual being. But it feels like Tom Cruise here is, like, captured, or, you know, the camera is capturing him in a way that it's sort of not paying attention or as much attention to other actors that I thought it might have.
That's interesting. I didn't have that same experience, but perhaps it's because I hadn't just seen this movie, so I was watching it more for the overall experience, understanding mm-hmm. that the point of the discussion would be Tom Cruise. But that's interesting. Now it makes me want to watch it again and see if I'm looking for him, he stands out.
Well, Aislinn, did you like this movie? Did you enjoy watching this?
Yes, I think so. I think it checks a lot of boxes that I tend to enjoy. So,
okay.
Band of Misfits. I love a coming-of-age story. I get made fun of in my household for liking so much stuff that happens in high school.
Oh, no. Do not get made fun of, because that is exactly my wheelhouse.
Yeah, you are in a safe place here. We have a high school slumber party podcast on our network, so.
I also like seeing, you know, Mike pointed out, there's a bucket full of movie stars before they were movie stars. In this,
yep.
I think that's fun. It's not behind the scenes, but because now some of these folks we've been able to watch through a big portion of their lives and a big portion of our lives, there's something a little bit behind the scenes about it, kind of seeing the origin of their craft a little bit. I have complex feelings about Rob Lowe we don't have to get into, but I did very much enjoy his first book, where he talked a lot about the process of getting cast and being in this film and what it was like to all be, you know, in the hotel together and the relationships and stuff there. So I think because I had that behind the scenes, I bring that in to watching it.
There's just like a camaraderie or energy between them that just feels like something went on behind the scenes together where they bonded hard over something. Because it comes, I mean, if not for anything else, that comes through to me. They just feel completely natural, like real friends, and like there's a real pecking order between them and everything.
Yeah, I think they achieved an authenticity that is palpable.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Like, there's a scene. So I guess if you haven't seen The Outsiders, it is about this group of young misfits, the ragtag bunch of misfits, as Aislinn's been calling them. They are sort of the, you know, the lower class kids in this town. And there's also the Socs, who are the, you know, the white bread, ritzy town people in this, you know, 1960s Oklahoma town.
Yeah, I liked how the Outsiders are literally from the other side of the tracks.
Yes.
I thought that was a nice touch, just, you know, for younger viewers.
Well, I mean, like, that saying, you know, came from a point where, like, that was reality, I would imagine, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. In this movie, there's a lot of tension. Like, there's one point where, like, they're about to rumble, and I wrote down, like, oh, this is the first conflict of the movie. And I was like, wait a minute. Literally every scene has been a fight. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it starts with a fight.
They're fighting in every scene. You know, even in the beginning, like, Matt Dillon finds those little kids and just, like, steals their playing cards, makes them play a pickup, 52-card pickup, and it's just like, I hate kids, and then chases after them. Like, every scene, they're just, like, antagonizing strangers or, you know, enemies or friends or whatever.
Aislinn said the very first scene, he's walking home from a movie and the Socs pull a switchblade on him. Yeah. Just for walking home. I was like, whoa. I was like, I did not remember how heated this is right from the jump. I think it starts at a level and really is able to maintain there. Like, I'm like Machio sometimes. Like, I'm like tense watching this movie. Like, waiting, because I feel like they could get jumped at any second.
Well, we know from Too Fast, Too Forever that you are either Kylo Ren or the Hulk, so I would not want to cross you.
If attacked, I mean, I don't want to start a fight, but if attacked, I will go into my rage, I suppose.
So Johnny and Ponyboy are hanging out, and some Socs show up, and they start beating up on Ponyboy, and then Johnny saves him by killing a guy with a knife, chasing everybody off, and then they're on the run. Like, that's in the first, like, 20, 25 minutes. Then they go away to a cabin.
Church. The church in the countryside.
So Dallas shows up and is just, you know, basically taking care of him. He brings him to burgers. And then on their way back, they see this burning, you know, school, right? They save these kids and they're seen as heroes now. That's when they come back to town. And then sort of, you know, things go from there. They get burned and Johnny gets very burned in the fire and eventually dies in the hospital. And all the while, there's sort of tensions bubbling between the greasers and the Socs because a greaser killed a Soc and, you know, they got to get retribution and all this different stuff. There's a big fight. Then Johnny loses his mind at the end, attempts maybe to kill a doctor, robs a convenience store, then gets gunned down by the police. In the middle of all that, what inspired that whole explanation, aside from just, you know, background for the podcast, is there's a scene, you know, the camaraderie that you guys are talking about. There's a scene where they're at the hospital and Ponyboy is there and, like, Rob Lowe and Patrick Swayze see him and they just look so genuinely relieved and happy and overjoyed.
Well, they're brothers. Patrick Swayze, Rob Lowe, and yes, you know, are all brothers and taking care of each other. There's no parents.
Yeah, their parents just passed away.
The look of, like, just joy on their face is palpable. You know what I mean? Like, I know that they're brothers, but it still feels like this real, it just feels like reality bleeding through the screen.
Yeah, I feel like this is a very, very well-acted film. Like, Uncle Francis did a really good job here. Like, this is, he captured something, like, about all, like, just the emotion behind it. Because most of the times when greasers are depicted in films, they're the tough guys, right? Like, they're the ones always starting shit and all that. But, like, here, these are just people. They were dealt this hand. They didn't ask for it. And, like, they're just trying to live the best they can. And so we see, like, all the home lives are very volatile situations. Like, no one's got a good home life or anything, and these three brothers trying to take care of each other, and they don't really know how. And so when one of them goes missing and shows back up after this, you know, he could have died too. Yeah, like, it comes through. So it, like, that's the thing, like, all those, like, those moments come through just as much as the other moments that make me scared, like, you know, with the fights and the switchblades and everything. Like, I feel like Uncle Francis did a really good job here of these, like, emotional beats and, like, where they should land and everything. So everyone's really on point. Plus, it's Swayze. Like, every time I see him, I lose it. So
I agree, but I also want to give credit to the source material for providing more than an outline, but, you know, providing the foundation for this. I agree, the camaraderie and that is great. What also really sticks out to me, and again, I did just come from facilitating a program about this, but that these young men are allowed and invited to be whole humans. So, yeah, they are greasers, but also they care about each other. Like you mentioned, finding their brother at the hospital, and a number of them break down and cry at different points. And I think they're just allowed to show such variety in their masculinity that is surprising if you kind of take into account when it was written and when it was made and then compare it to now. I'm not saying the whole thing is, but I think it has some great examples of showing that it's okay to feel and express a range of emotion. And we don't always see that with stories that are so focused on young men.
Yeah.
What about the Tom Cruise of it all?
Speaking of Uncle Francis, Mike, we do not have Nicolas Cage in here, but we do have Little Domino with her very big buck teeth. You know, Mr. Can You Please Spare a Dime? She is adorable in this movie.
I love her movies, but I kind of secretly wish that she also had an acting career still. Like, I know she never wanted to, really, but, like, I always liked her in front of the screen as well.
Yeah, me too. But I think that's a good way to transition into our main man, Tom Cruise, because he's also got some teeth going on in this movie.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the first time I saw this, I was like, what is going on there? Well, real quick question before we dive deep into Cruz. And I guess this is also kicking off, you know, so like Emilio Estevez is in this movie, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And Rob Lowe's in this movie. And like, I don't know if you knew that the Lowe's and the Sheens grew up across the street from each other. And they were like all great friends growing up and everything. I started wondering if Tom Cruise was here because Charlie Sheen couldn't make it. There's a very similar vibe at this point in time between the two of them that I never put together. And so I was here going, is he surrogate Sheen at this point or something? Or like, what's going on? But ultimately, by the end, it's all him. He makes it his own. I'm not missing Charlie Sheen by any means at the end of this movie. It's just a thought that popped into my head.
Well, so according to IMDb, and I don't know if you knew this because you basically said a different version of this, but Emilio Estevez and Tom Cruise were childhood friends.
Oh,
and okay. They auditioned together, and then they both got the parts. In the movie, they're kind of buds, right? They both kind of work at the gas station, or at least Emilio Estevez works at the gas station and Cruz like hangs around. But I think he's got the gas station attendant uniform that he wears. They show up to the house together when Pony Boy is cooking the eggs.
And they're in Mission Impossible together too down the line.
Oh,
so we'll get back to
look
that.
At that. Yeah. Look at that.
If you're interested in more of that, stories of the casting and all that, there is a behind the scenes. A lot of that was recorded, and I don't know, you could probably Google it to find it, but also if you, in Rob Lowe's book, there's like multiple chapters about how they, you know, all the, it wasn't really chemistry testing, but like they would all get together and be filmed doing stuff, and it was a very long process back and forth about who was going to play what part and all that, and there's just, there's a whole ton of backstory just about that, so if you're interested in that, check out Stories I Only Tell My Friends, or Stories I Tell My Friends.
That's awesome.
There's a lot there.
One thing that there's also apparently, I just watched this on HBO Go. Like, I don't own the DVD for this, but there's apparently also a DVD commentary.
Yes.
So there's probably also secrets and stories in there as well. The one thing that I read on IMDb about that was that during filming, Tom Cruise got the script for Risky Business. He apparently had asked Diane Lane to play Lana, who I guess is a prostitute. Another movie I have not seen, but we'll see.
No, it's the Rebecca De Mornay.
De Mornay.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Diane Lane apparently in the commentary says, quote, very quietly to the other actors that he had asked her during filming to play Lana. Her father told her there was no way in hell she was going to play a hooker in this movie.
Call girl. Come on.
This feels like the kind of movie, whether it's, you know, memoirs or DVD commentaries, that feels like there are just stories to be had. When we talked about Taps, Mike, we talked about how everybody stayed at that hotel, or everybody stayed on site except for maybe Tom Cruise stayed at a hotel, or who knows. But apparently, but maybe this is also in those books, and so Isla, maybe
it
you know
is.
About this.
Yep.
They all stayed at this one hotel, and they were apparently assholes to basically the entire hotel, would just do like lots of pranks and stuff, which reminds me, Mike, of My Five Dads at That Diner a little bit.
Okay, well.
So years later, Tom Cruise met up with somebody who's like, oh, I was working at that hotel that you guys stayed at, and the first thing Tom Cruise said was, I'm sorry. he just apologized, because it was just a bunch of young kids who were, you know, in the movie at least, without supervision, and probably in real life without too much supervision, running amok, and, you know, all good-looking, young, becoming affluent dudes, living it up. And so I can't imagine the stories that happened on that set. I might have to read that Rob Lowe book.
You should. The one thing I'll add, and I'll leave all the Matt Dillon stuff for when you read the book. Yes, they were in a hotel, and the greasers and socias were separated. So they each had a floor to maximize that antagonism. So I think some of the hijinks included the kind of pranks, et cetera, back and forth, because they were not sequestered, but they, you know, they again, that authenticity reads on the screen. That was intentional to keep them in their downtime, kind of to their own groups. For the betterment of the film. But anyway, okay, enough trivia. Let's cruise it up.
So, Aislinn, before we talk about Tom Cruise, and maybe this is the way to kickstart the conversation, this is something that we talk about on all these episodes now. What was your favorite part of the movie? Was it something that Tom Cruise did, or was it something that another character did? Like, what was your favorite part, or moment, or scene, or line?
I thought you were going to say, was it something Tom Cruise did, or something Tom Cruise said?
In later movies, I think it's going to be a lot of Tom. Like, Mike and I have been saying, you know, our favorite moments in these first couple of movies have been what he did, because that's why we're here. But in this movie, there's a lot of exciting things happening. But so what was your favorite thing that he either did or said or had no part with?
I absolutely enjoyed watching Diane Lane. I found her to be a real kind of bright spot in it. Everyone's good, but kind of among all these, you know, young dudes walking around. So I liked whenever she was part of the story. In this moment, I think what's really coming up for me is the time when Ponyboy and Johnny are in the church together, and it's just them.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of the things they share and you know, what do you do when it's just the two of you, and read Gone with the Wind, I guess. But their camaraderie in that desperate situation is probably my favorite. But this is one, because there's so many people and so much going on, that I think with each watching, something else stands out. Yeah. So in this watching, I would say that.
I like it. And Mike, what about you? What was your favorite thing in The Outsiders?
Obviously, it's a Cruz thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think he's so weird in this, like, from his car backflips to the chocolate cake to just, like, sticking a newspaper in his pants and everything.
Oh, I wrote that newspaper down. Absolutely.
Like, I love all that stuff, but I feel like it's a little, I don't know if it's a little cheap to pick one of those things again.
No wrong answers.
You know what really kind of surprised me this time was I liked at the end, okay, where, like, it seems like everything's back to normal and we're watching the brothers and suddenly there's just, like, this spark and they start arguing again and it's like, oh, the cycle continues and Rob Lowe, like, runs out of the house and now he's running away, but they all catch up with him at, like, the baseball field, and they, like, have it out with each other, sort of, like, spill their guts in front of each other, and they have, like, a good sort of cry as bros, and then they all go back home, and I was like, wow, I totally forgot that moment. I have two brothers also, you know, and, like, we've definitely shared those moments before, so I was like, wow, that I felt that this time, so I think I'm gonna go with that moment.
Nice, that's a great one.
You know, mine is going to sort of pale in comparison to that, but it's something you said. It didn't really strike me at first, but when Cruz and Emilio Estevez first show up to the house and Ponyboy's cooking eggs, Emilio Estevez takes a beer out of the fridge, and Tom Cruise looks at him and is just like, oh, you're drinking beer for breakfast? Like, putting this guy down. And then Tom Cruise proceeds to pick up just a half of a chocolate cake and just eat that. So I didn't realize in the moment that he's like, I can't believe that, like, that's what you're choosing to eat for breakfast. And then Tom Cruise just shoves chocolate cake into his face, getting chocolate smeared all over his mouth, you know, making weird faces, like, silently in the background while other people are talking, just eating chocolate cake. Like, it's just such a weird, specific character moment, and I just love it. And especially I love the irony, I guess, of the insult to Emilio Estevez for him to only sort of trump that himself.
I'll never forget when I was, like, a kid watching this, and Emilio takes the beer and the rest of the cake and sits down, like, in front of the TV set to, like, finish his breakfast. I was like, oh my god, I love this.
Now, Aislinn, do you have a least favorite moment in The Outsiders?
Yes. I think it's well documented. I don't like watching fighting. I don't like listening to fighting. So when people say, well, just close your eyes, like, the Foley work of it is almost worse. I think they are very successful in creating that idea, like you said, Mike, that you could be jumped at any point. But that it, you know, just starts off with this poor kid just walking home. And immediately there is the threat of, like, imminent physical violence. But yeah, I don't like that. So yeah, if you look at some of just on paper kind of what's in this movie, it's not all for me. But I think it all works together enough that I can hang in there for it. But yeah, definitely the fighting and murdering of people was my least favorite part.
I think that's very, very both well documented, as you said, and also very valid. Mike, what about you? What's your least favorite moment in The Outsiders?
Again, there's a lot of tough moments for me in this too. Like, I know it's intentional, but Coppola just, like, is able to create that sense of dread, like, a lot of times. Like, when you think, like, things have blown over, and then it's like, oh shit, like, they totally haven't. Ultimately, what got me harder than I was expecting is when Ralph Macchio dies. Like, it just broke my heart for some reason this time. Like, I don't know, like, maybe I'm just going through a tough time or something, but, like, that kid's life and, like, his journey in this movie over the course of, like, 2 or 3 days or whatever is just incredible. Like, yeah, so I really was feeling it for Macchio this time.
You know, mine's going to sort of piggyback off that a little bit, and I just hate, and I understand that on a certain level, but I hate when people going through, you know, what Matt Dillon's going through, then sort of take that out on innocents around them. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when he's, you know, intimidating the doctor, like, you know, pulls the trigger of the gun in the doctor's face, you know, it's empty, but then he robs a convenience store. Like, he's on a self-destructive pattern that is, on the one hand, understandable, but on the other hand, I don't want to see that. Like, just, you know, there's got to be more constructive ways to deal with that grief. even though he's wrapped up in that moment, he's sort of, you know, his emotions are taking the better of him. But, you know, it's tough. I mean, it's a tough thing to go through, but be better.
His character for me is the one I kind of understand the least, too, to be honest. Like, he lives at that roadhouse. We get very little about his family, and he seems extremely resourceful, and I don't know, there's just, and he's more wild mm-hmm. than the rest of them as well. There's something like kind of off about him, I guess, that I just feel danger from him because I don't understand him, I guess.
Is that the same roadhouse, Mike, that Patrick Swayze will return to in a handful of years?
Most definitely, I would
probably
say.
Probably. Three rules. Take it outside. I actually do want to say another one of my favorite moments, and it's the one line that I wrote down. That Tom Cruise, when they're on the way to the Rumble, you know, they all gather together at the house and they're leaving the house to meet up with the other greasers. And Patrick Swayze does that, like, incredible vault over the fence. You know, Mike, we are three movies in the Cruise Club, and we had one of the greatest acrobatic stunts I've ever seen in a movie in Endless Love, where the dad gets hit by the taxi cab.
Almost forgotten about that.
Never forget it. Mike, never forget about that.
It's seared into my brain.
So that's number one. And then here, we've got Patrick Swayze, and they apparently all did their own gymnastic stunts. That Patrick Swayze, like, vaults onto the fence, does the 180 turn, and then, like, vaults off. I was like, what? And then Tom Cruise gets up on the car and does, like, that back tuck jump, like the spin off the car. According to IMDb, had just eaten a bunch and felt like he couldn't do it, and so he went and vomited. He ate raw eggs until he vomited and then was able to do it, but he nails it. You know, even Eisen, if you don't like that they're basically heading into battle, there's, like, this real sense of excitement and terror and all these emotions that Uncle Francis captures so perfectly. And as they're walking, Tom Cruise says, "Ain't nobody gonna call the fuzz in this neighborhood because they know better." And it's like, they know not to fuck with us, that we'll take them down. Like, this is us versus the Socs. This is our ground. Let's do it. And I just was like, oh yeah, like that, like that's maybe his big line in this movie, but I love that line.
I was trying to search for lines throughout this, and I don't know, I didn't end up writing any of them down, but all of the dialogue just was cool to me. I don't know, it all seemed to flow really well. There's a lot of interesting turns of phrase and stuff, and I think a couple of them were putting on some accents and things, and that was cool, but I definitely agree, like, that moment is charged, like, it's electric, and Swayze is just an Adonis, you know, like, he could do anything. Like, he's jumping out of airplanes in Point Break because that's what he loves to do. Like, he jumped out of airplanes for fun. Yeah, this whole thing about the Rumble, the turf war, like, it builds and builds. I mean, and then my favorite thing about the Rumble, like, if I had to say, is just I like how it starts raining, which I assume is, like, metaphorical, like, it's metaphorical rain, like, they've fought so much that, like, the heavens have opened up and it, you know, trying to cool them off or something, I don't know, but I just thought that was an interesting touch, just that, like, oh, the weather changed in the middle of this fight.
It also feels like in that scene it's not always raining. Maybe that's just camera angles. Maybe that's, I don't know what that was, but it felt like there were a couple shots where there just wasn't rain. So maybe it is a metaphor. I don't know.
You'll have to read Rob Lowe's book,
I guess, or the very definition of scattered showers.
That day, the rain machine was on the fritz, and Francis just wasn't having it. So he just yelled action and was like, I'll fix it in post.
A couple of things I noticed about Tom Cruise. He has, a feather tattoo on his right arm.
I was trying to picture what that was.
I think it's not a real tattoo, though, right?
It's not his.
I don't think so.
I think he's unmarked. I don't know.
No, his body is a temple. Like, there's a reason that he has basically stayed looking the same for the last 20 years, because he treats his body like a temple. And he also has a arm wrestling match, I believe, with Rob Lowe in this movie, and wins. So, one for one there.
He's basically just like a dirty mess this whole movie, too. Yeah. Well, they all are, right? Like, I just thought that was... I really felt that through the screen, too. Just, like, they're caked with a layer of grime and dirt and grease that, like, is obvious. You know, I was like, whoa, he probably smells bad.
And I guess the only thing that, I mean, we've talked about it already, but I guess the only other really sort of big thing to address is that final rumble where they all get there and they meet up with the other greasers and the Socs come and they battle. And, you know, again, according to IMDb, there are so many bodies just flying around that, like, Tom Cruise both broke his thumb and also got punched in the jaw and needed, like, emergency dental surgery the next day.
Was it shot, like, in sequence? Is that why maybe there's something going on with his teeth earlier in the movie?
Because he
got beat up in the rumble later in the movie or something?
But... maybe.
There's that line. What happened to his character? Because there's the line after the rumble where they're like, yeah, he's like, it don't look too bad, do it? And he's like, well, you just got a hole in your face. I was like, wait, what happened to him? He got a hole in his face? Something happened to him, his character, at the rumble, too. So maybe they wrote that in.
Yeah, maybe they ad-libbed that based on what actually happened. But Emilio Estevez had his lip cut. C. Thomas Howell got a black eye. Tom Cruise broke his thumb and needed dental work done after being punched in the jaw. So a lot of stuff going on with that in that rumble.
I like the moment in right before it starts where the leader of the Socs comes up and shakes Swayze's hand and he's like, I got you. And he's like, what's up with this guy? He's like, yeah, they used to be buddies and stuff. I was like, whoa, what happened in this neighborhood? Like, between that one little line just kicked off this train of thought in my mind where it was just like, you know, these guys were friends. There was nothing dividing them when they played football in high school. And it's like, now that they're out in life, just because one lives somewhere and someone lives somewhere else, or their social status, like, they're not allowed to socialize and be friends. Like, it's just a really messed up rule of society or whatever. It's just what happens. It's just a shame. So there's a lot in that moment alone, and it's just a tiny little moment. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like you could easily imagine a scenario in which, okay, yeah, it's great, everyone's out playing football, and like the parents of a Soch would be like, yeah, it's good that you're all on a team, but you know, their bad influences, shouldn't hang out with them, or, you know what I mean? I think that's still a social class determines so much of our, you know, experiences, et cetera, et cetera, and what we're allowed to do or expected to do. And I think there's a lot, too, to be said for, you know, perception versus reality. And if you have the reputation of being a greaser, then people are going to treat you that way, right? Yeah. Or if you have that reputation and you internalize that, then that, I think that's some of the Dylan of it all, is that there's an expectation that he's crazy and he's going to mess up and he's violent and he's all that. And so that, I think, is part of what fuels that, you know, breakdown and eventual suicide by police.
Yeah. The greasers all really wear it as like a badge of honor and a mark of pride that they are greasers. Like, Emilio Estevez makes a joke about how he doesn't, you know, that one guy doesn't go to the, he goes to the barber for an oil change, not a haircut. And, you know, when Pony Boy and Johnny have to cut their hair and dye their hair, they're terrified because that's like who they are. And so they're all internalizing it. They're all, you know, this is who they are.
It's their community. That's what they have, yeah. Right? They're not allowed, they're not welcome into other social groups. This is their, it's their family, and absolutely, it's their identity.
Yeah, it was interesting when they saved all those kids, and then, like, I assumed it was the teacher or maybe the bus driver, but, like, there's the man, C. Thomas Howell, is, like, sharing a cigarette with him in the emergency waiting room at the hospital. He's like, yeah, we're greasers. And he's like, I never thought a greaser do anything that good, or something, you know, paraphrasing and stuff. But it's, yep, like, there's the moment. It's right there again, the message. So it's cool how it's like, yes, it's obvious. Greaser social, it's an obvious device, but there are these great little moments that are kind of just like little throwaway moments that really reveal a lot. So I thought that was very, very cool watching it this time around. There's a lot more depth to it than I recalled.
You know, one thing that I forgot about this movie that maybe is from the book, maybe not, I don't know, and Aislinn, you might know this, but it's something that we talked about when we recorded our A League of Their Own episode for your show, Aislinn, for the Contenders,
yeah,
was just how that movie is all framed within a flashback from Gina, mm-hmm, Davis's character. This is all told in an essay that Ponyboy is writing.
Right.
It feels kind of unnecessary, I think. And it also takes away a little bit of the drama or the suspense that, like, when he is hiding away or he is in a fight, that, like, he's going to be okay because he's the one telling the story. And I don't know if we need that framing device. I don't know if we need to know that this is from his, you know, that he's the one telling the story. I think we can sort of just jump in and then have an ending similar to the ones in the movie without really giving away that he survives.
I took it differently as, in addition to being the youngest of the brothers, I feel like all the brothers sort of, and the other greasers, see something different in him a little bit than themselves, or he's special in some way, I feel like. And part of that, I think, is that he has, I get, maybe I'm putting a bunch of stuff on it, but like this talent for writing and expressing himself, and I think that's part of why they're maybe protective of him. And so I, for me, the, you know, bookending it that way is, I don't know, kind of makes that more full circle, that he's fulfilling that potential that others see in him. And then also just because the book was written by such a young person, I felt like it was appropriate that a young person was telling the story.
Is that framing device in the book from what you remember?
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I did like it, though, that we got to see him leave the movie theater twice. Like, I thought that was, like, Francis took it pretty far where he was like, nope, like, it's, yep, we're going to end right at the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, exactly there. Also, Joey, check this out. So, right in the opening here, Cruz Nexion. So, C. Thomas Howell leaves the movie theater. He's seeing The Hustler. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise will be in the sequel, The Color of Money.
Oh, I did not know that was a sequel. Yeah. Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
So, censors going wild right at the start.
That's a sort of a preemptive Cruz Nexion. So, the only other note that I have is that Tom Cruise auditioned for the Matt Dillon role, the Patrick Swayze role, the Rob Lowe role, and the one played by Darren Dalton, Randy Anderson, until he finally was cast as good old Steve Randall.
Steve.
So he had his eyes on, you know, bigger, meatier parts, but then eventually wound up here. But I think, you know, without spoiling things, I think he did okay in his career from here on out without being the lead. I don't know for sure, but... Aizen, any other thoughts about the Outsiders before we play a couple games?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, you say games, and then I'm ready for games.
Mike, any other thoughts about the Outsiders before we move on?
So far, like, we're on a roll. Like, yep. We're starting hot with Cruise Club here, and just these three performances, like, he's really bringing it, and, like, I don't know, I just get a good sense that, like, he loves doing this, and so it's going to be really fun to watch someone where it's, like, apparent as they're acting, like, it kind of feels like he knows he's acting, and he loves doing it, and he's good at it and stuff, so, like, I don't know, I get this. That might sound weird.
No, I like that. I love watching people do what they love, you know, even if I'm at a concert and there's a band and it's kind of crappy, mm-hmm. I love that they're living their dream.
Yeah, he seems to be having so much fun, and I'm having a lot of fun watching him, and so I'm glad. I'm glad that this is happening.
I think he'd be so happy that you're having a good time.
It's why he's doing it, right? For us to be entertained.
From all reports, it seems like he's, like, genuinely, like, the nicest guy on set and, like, just, like, happy to be there and remembers everybody's name to an inhuman level, remembers everybody's name. And it just feels like this is always what he wanted to do, what he was meant to do, and he's doing it. And it's you know, Mike, you're exactly right. Like, it's great and it's fun to watch. I was also thinking, Mike, that once again, just like our last handful of podcasts, I am ranking on Letterboxd. I'm Soul Popped on Letterboxd if you want to go find me over there. If you're listening and you're on Letterboxd, my rankings already for the first three are already messed up. Like, I don't know how to rank these three movies. But I was also thinking, like, these could be three, not that they're bad at all, but that they could be three of, like, the bottom 5 or 10 movies that we watch.
Yeah, and, you know, Taps, not a great movie, but I was very entertained. I had no idea, because I don't know anything about that life, like kids in military school and stuff. So I was entertained, but right, I think you're right. Like, these are just okay movies, and we're having, like, so much fun with them that when we start getting into, like, the real meat and potatoes, like, it's just going to be a feast. It's going to be a festival.
Mm-hmm. You know, these first three movies I've given all, like, 3 or 3.5 stars to on Letterboxd, and, like,
they're so insane. Like, each movie has had, like, even aside from Cruise, has had just, like, blowout, like, crazy moments that, like, what is going on? This movie is so nuts kind of thing.
Yeah. All right, now, Aizen, our first game, we played it last week on Hanks for the Memories. If Tom Hanks was cast as Steve Randall, what would this part in The Outsiders look like? We are recording this episode in the midst of two, what I can only imagine, we've not recorded the second one yet, but two very long Bosom Buddies episodes. So I've got Bosom Buddies on the brain. Aizen, what do you think, knowing, you know, having watched all 19 episodes of the first season of Bosom Buddies, what would The Outsiders be like if Tom Hanks, circa 1983, was in this movie?
His performance would be different, of course, but I think that in that early era, I think he would bring something wild, something weird that would kind of fit in, maybe parallel what Tom Cruise is doing. And I'd say that because of some of the real broad kind of moments in Bosom Buddies, no pun intended, where he can be wild and crazy or do something a little off the wall. And I obviously was not there on the set of this, but I feel like these young actors were given freedom to make choices and create moments even with the kind of background, you know, greaser characters like Tom Cruise kind of was. And so I, while it would be different, I know, I think his version of cake all over your face would be something else. I think he would be equally weird and wild.
Like from my favorite episodes in season one, like the rewrite, just, you know, whipped cream pie all over the face. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, exactly. He has that. He, and I think he has a different sense of humor, but a sense of humor that would mix with this group and kind of bring something different.
Mike, what about you? What if Tom Hanks, knowing what we know, we're both in the middle of watching season two right now of Bosom Buddies. What would this movie be like if Tom Hanks was in the role of Steve Randall?
I think it would work. I think he could bring a lot of his own sort of little Hanks-isms into this group, and the dynamic would still be there. Like, I think he would still get along and like have a rapport with Emilio. Like, he does different stuff than Cruise. Like, he does voices a lot on I feel like on Bosom Buddies. Like, he'll launch into an impression or something, and he's got a great laugh, so I feel like he'll throw that laugh out a little bit more, where he's like, ha ha ha. The one thing I don't know if he could do is the greasy hair, because he's got like that curly hair, you know, like that afro stuff. So like, I don't know, I'd die to see what that looks like, though. 1982 Hanks with just like slick grease back pompadour hair style. Love to see it. I don't think he'd pull off the car backflip, but I think he'd find something else to do, you
exactly.
know, to make
he'd
himself stand
else.
Up. Yeah, yeah. So I would actually love to see that.
You know, one thing that I think would be maybe similar is, especially in season two, I think a little bit in season one, but like, there are a handful of Bosom Buddies episodes that just end on like this really, really somber note, which we'll be talking about next week in season two's discussion over on Hanks for the Memories. But I feel like that even early on, Tom Hanks is able to show, he can land the dramatic moments. Even if they didn't necessarily fit the tone of the episode, when the tone suddenly switched to being, oh, shit got real for a second, he's able to do that. And I think in this movie, where for the most part it's rascals having fun, and then all of a sudden their friend dies, or their friend killed the guy, or, you know, their other friend got gunned down by the police, where like there's real things that life is throwing at them, Tom Hanks in that role could really kind of land that like somber reflection that is sort of necessary, that, you know, he is obviously able to like goof around and have fun and be one of the guys or one of the girls, if you know what I mean. He's also able to really, when it matters, come through and really sort of land that heavy moment. So I think it might be even a little bit more serious. Like, he wouldn't be maybe as, it'd be playful in a different way than Tom Cruise, but I think that Tom Hanks would sort of kind of realize, like, the gravity of the situation would set in on him, and he would come to terms with, like, oh, yeah, shit got real. And, you know, sort of have that moment of reflection. So I think that could be, that's what's in my mind right now in terms of if Hanks was in this. Now, Aislinn, going from if Hanks was in this, that if you were in this, you won a walk-on role into The Outsiders, there's not a lot of women in this movie.
Nope.
If you were to Stan Lee yourself, what's your Stanio, your Stan Lee cameo, to steal the phrase from HTML, another show on the podcast network, all covering currently the Marvel Cinematic Universe. If you're going to Stan Lee yourself into this movie, Aislinn, where would you be? What would you be doing? Who would you be talking to? Or not?
That's a thinker. Because I am so comfortable in the precocious little sister role in my life, I would insert some little cameo where when the greasers are walking through their neighborhood, I would be somebody's little sister. And either try to join them or do something of in the vein of, well, I'm gonna tell mom, or, you know, something. I would be trying to catch up with the greasers as a little sister.
I like that. Now, Mike, you and I have an easier option here, because this movie is teeming with dudes and just raw male sexual energy, as you and I are both known to exude.
Speak for yourself. No, I'm
So if you want a walk-on role, if you're going to Stan Lee yourself into this movie, where would you be? What would you be doing?
Yeah, there's a lot of places to be here. I think I'm going to go with a true sort of cameo. I'm not going to like be part of the crew, part of the greasers, or I'm not going to be a Solsh or any of that. I'm going to come up to the gas station with my bike that has a deflated tire.
Oh, okay.
And like baseball cards in its spokes and stuff, and I'm gonna ask Tom Cruise and them and be like, y'all got a you got a bike pump I could borrow? And they'd be like, sure, kid. And then after they do that, I'd be like, well, now get your ass out of here, get home, we don't like children. They're gonna throw a bunch of cards at me, tell me to go away.
You know, I think I'm gonna put myself at that burning school, and you know, maybe it's just that they are trying to maintain the kids that they have or whatever, but it feels like the adults in the situation aren't really doing much. And I think there'd be a good way that I could just be like all like sort of sooted up, hands on hips or hands on head, just like walking back and forth, like I don't know what to do, and just, you know, the school is burning beside me, and I'm just like, I can't do anything. And then I'm just overjoyed when our greasers show up and save the day, but I'm just there like this, you know, inability to do anything. So that's, I don't know why that stuck in my head, but that was the first thing I thought of, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of okay being completely useless in this movie.
All right. It was kind of weird though how, like, yeah, no one was running in to try and help the kids during that moment. I don't know. It's a good thing they came along.
Absolutely.
There's the sort of thing where, like, you need to make sure that you're safe in that situation, right? Like, if you're on a crashing airplane, you, like, you put your own oxygen mask on first before you help the person next to you or whatever. It's the same kind of thing. Like, if you're going to...
But they're children.
Believe me, I fully agree with you. I'm just trying to maybe kind of explain why the teacher is not doing... Or the bus driver or whatever is not doing anything. I don't know. But yeah, I would just be like, oh,
fear,
I can't believe
powerful.
It.
Fear is very powerful. You know, especially fire. One of the
And shocked.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't judge that guy. Trying not to.
Do not judge, lest ye be judged. We have an email just here on the show, run@cageclub.me. If you write in, first person to write in with an email about the show, I'll send you a little prize if you want to share your mailing address with me. run@cageclub.me. We have no emails today, but let us know what you think of this podcast, of the Tom Tom Club as a whole. You know, what you think of The Outsiders, what you think of next movie, you know, in 2 weeks, which is going to be Losing It. Just, you know, say hi, run@cageclub.me. We'll either read it on air, or if you don't want us to read it on air, you know, just send a note and just say, don't read on air, but just here's what I'm thinking, and we'll go from there. We also have a Patreon page, patreon.com/cageclub, where if you have a couple extra dollars, you want to support what we do, not just this show, but all of the shows on the network, you can kick a couple bucks in over there, you get some merch, you can help control what Mike and I watch. We've got a handful of ideas of some bonus content that we can do for the Patreon page, so if you're interested in some different things that we are not doing yet, go to patreon.com/cageclub and just kick in a couple bucks. Now, Aislinn, I have the most important question of the day.
Yeah.
Does Tom Cruise run in this movie?
Yes, absolutely.
Would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, totally, right?
Absolutely. I
mean, did my eyes deceive me? We all watched the same movie.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%.
100%. I don't know if you know this, Aislinn, but his Twitter bio, basically his all of his social media bio, it says running in movies since 1981, which is why our email address is run, which is why we asked this question, which if you
I'm
download the
I'm just surprised
MP3s,
he has Twitter.
I know. Right? It's
a little surprised, too.
It's very promotional. He doesn't actually, yeah, like... Sure. It's not like his stereotypically like what he's having for lunch or whatever, but it's more
like how I have a Twitter.
Yes, to communicate with his fans.
Even Hanks uses his to like say, "Oh, I found a glove or a shoe."
Hanks got a weird Twitter going.
Great on Twitter.
Yeah,
but yeah, it just seems like whenever a new Cruise movie comes out, it gets active. It activates again and it starts tweeting.
So the last thing we have to do on the show, the Tom Cruise Awards, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to be.
We had that
yet.
Thing from Taps. What were those?
The golden oak leaves.
Yeah, those oak leaves he really admired.
Golden oak leaves.
But okay. We'll see. Anything for the chocolate cake awards.
The gross eating in movies award.
We'll see. So okay. So what categories cake. We have? Best film, worst film. I don't think this is either of those. Best of the worst, most fun, bad film. No. Best role, worst role, most wasted performance. I don't think any of those apply here. I think he's used well. It's just, it's not necessarily his best or his worst role. Best fight. Absolutely.
The Rumble, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, there's lots of fights, but the Rumble, I guess we'll have to nominate.
Yeah, certainly deserves a nomination.
He does not dance in this movie.
Unfortunately, because I was thinking
he does a flip.
Because I felt, you know, it was hard not to at times think maybe like West Side Story or something like that while watching this. And I was like, this could use, like, I'd love to see these guys break into dance and start singing like their hearts out. Like that would have been incredible. Like Outsiders the musical one day, possibly. I don't know.
You know, I just thought, you know, Aislinn, you said, you know, the flip. I just had it feels so perfect for a Tom Cruise award show. Most athletic feat.
Yep.
Yeah.
Backflip.
Because already here he's doing his own stunts and that's really what he's pushing these days. Like, I do my stunts, come watch me break my ankle.
Yep.
And it works. I'm there.
Best death, he does not die. Best outfit, wardrobe, gas station attendant uniform.
I was going to say denim vest with no shirt.
Denim vest with no shirt. All right.
Joey, that's a real too fast, too furious Tyrese look where he's got the sleeveless denim.
Yeah.
The shirt open.
It's a shirt that he takes off to punch out that window, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what it seemed like to me.
Best line. I do like the line that I mentioned earlier that no one in this neighborhood is going to call the police because they know better, but it's not as good as so far. It's beautiful, man. Beautiful. Or no, 8 years old and I was into arson, or I'd like to take a grenade and shove it right up their asses.
Beer for breakfast is kind of a fun line.
Beer for breakfast is a fun line. I just, you know, I think that that's going to be one that I sort of forget about.
Oh, I don't know. I think any time that we're hanging out and drinking beers, I'm going to say to you, beer for breakfast. I'm going to try to remember that.
So we have best running scene as well. So we have most athletic Pete and best running scene, two different categories. Worst love story, best love story, no. Most badass role? There's gonna be more badass roles, I think, than this.
Oh yeah.
And then here's the last question, unless there's another thing that we want to nominate that we have not mentioned yet. Best or worst non-Cruise actor, male or female? Is there anybody in this movie that we want to call out specifically? I feel like this is sort of the quintessential ensemble where everyone is good and not really anybody stands out in my eyes, but is there anybody that either of you think we should recognize for their work in The Outsiders? I mean, do we want to see Diane Lane as Cherry Valance?
Yeah, that was going to be the one that I would suggest, yes.
All right.
She definitely stands out. Out of the guys, it's tough. It's tough. Like,
I mean, we could do so last week when we recorded Hanks for the Memories, Bosom Buddies Season 1, we added the category Best Ensemble. We could do that here again.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of perfect. Yeah.
Best Ensemble cast, The Outsiders. I also feel like, just retroactively, we need to sort of add Taps in, because I feel like Taps is the same kind of, like, gang of misfits, although much more rigid misfits in that movie.
Yeah, and not quite as, like, I don't know those actors as well, necessarily. I mean, we do have Sean Penn in there and Tom Cruise, but, like, I don't feel like I knew the rest of those boys, per se, but, yeah,
right,
okay.
Boy chick. but, yes, okay, so we have 7 nominees so far, or 6, sorry. Best fight, best outfit, wardrobe, most athletic feats, best ensemble cast, best non-Cruise actor, female, Diane Lane. So, solid performance here in episode 3 of Cruise Club.
Nice.
Well, Aislinn, thank you so much for joining us. The last thing we do on the show is we feature a podcast here on the network. Because you are here, we are going to cede our time to you. Why don't you let the listeners know about The Contenders, the last episode that just came out this week as we're recording, which is the last episode as you're listening to this, was about A League of Their Own, where Mike and I were guests on there, sort of a jump ahead in Hanks. But why don't you talk a little bit about The Contenders and what episode is coming next with, if I must say, the other Joe?
A Hanks time hop, if you will. Absolutely. So The Contenders is a podcast I do with my brother Tobin Addington, also a Cage Club contributor and friend. It's about women in film, about fearless women in front of and behind the camera. We do contemporary movies as well as some older movies, and that's always fun to hop back and forth a little bit. As Joe said, yes, indeed, our most recent episode is A League of Their Own. Coming up next in another week and a half will be Copycat.
Very
I actually
cool.
don't know if it's a week and a half because I don't know when this is coming out.
No, it's like 4 days as this comes out.
Okay. Hey, so later this week, look out for Copycat.
Which is your backdoor pilot into the Harry Connick Jr. podcast.
It is the Connick of it all. To prepare yourselves for this, if you're interested in the Copycat episode, if we've piqued your curiosity, go back and listen to our Home for the Holidays episode, which is the first time Joe Bolenbaugh appeared on our program. We all had a really good time. Hopefully that comes through on the recording.
Oh, it did, because that's why I'm very jealous of him.
I'm so sorry.
it's the whole, I'm you know,
there's room in my life for many a Joe.
I know.
And so Joe was on that one. We've asked him back. This is our anniversary episode. It's been 1 year since we started.
Congratulations.
Ooh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So to celebrate, we're talking with Joe about Harry Connick Jr., which, I mean, I can't picture a better evening.
No, it sounds delightful. Your show comes out every other Tuesday at cageclub.me, and wherever you find this podcast, you can find that one. I've been on a handful of episodes. Mike's been on a couple episodes, so go check those out. Go check out Hanks for the Memories, the other part of this Tom Club, and come back in 2 weeks for Losing It, with a former and possibly future host of the Cage Club Podcast Network. I will not say who that is. You can do your own snooping at cageclub.me. But for all things Cruise Club and Hanks for the Memories and all things Tom Tom Club, you go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cageclub. Come back in 2 weeks for Losing It right here on Cruise Club. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Island Addington of the Contenders Podcast. And we'll see you in 2 weeks right here on Cruise Club.
Upon the moment long ago, one breath away and there you will be, so young and carefree. Again you will see that place in time.